What sort of person wants to get into politics? The answer might surprise you. After all, in our society, it's how you get things done. But nobody ever said it was easy. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, the last of our programs on the contested issues of the primary election now 1 week away. Our guest running for Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor. If you want to talk to Hollis Prince, the phone lines are open. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And you can call right now. Hollis Prince is with us in the studio today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
We all kind of assumed that Hollis French would try and run for governor, but when Byron Mallott decided to enter the race, Hollis stepped right up and said, okay, I'll run for lieutenant governor. Hollis French, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So are you? How did that work with your position as a state senator? I mean, technically, are you still a senator?
I am a senator until January of next year when the next crop gets sworn in. But in the redistricting process, whereas 4 years ago when I ran for governor, I had a free shot, as they say, the way the redistricting process worked, it also put my seat up again this year. So I had to choose between kind of going up for a higher position or sticking with the one I have.
I see. So theoretically, let's say ballot measure one passes.
Right.
There could be a special session, right?
Conceivably, right. The governor could call a special session to solve the oil tax problem in October, which would be just like we did it in 2007. A special session in October of 2007 is when we rode aces.
Yeah.
Which is actually the right way to do oil tax reform.
Well,
right?
Somehow I knew you would.
Right. Hey, you know.
I'm sorry to open the door on
that. No.
We may softball as well question so quickly here.
It's extremely important, and people should realize, you know, they've criticized the ACES session because it was only 30 days. It was 30 days, one subject only, and nothing else on the landscape. No capital budget to leverage people with. No other bills alive to leverage people with. You know, folks at the end of the session get deeply possessive about their own initiatives and their own ideas, and they'll do almost anything to get them through. And with oil taxes happening at the same time, it's a very volatile and very poor way to do business. We did ACES with only one subject on the table and with the lights on in committee, lots of experts. It was really, I think, a model way to do legislation.
Hollis French, state senator for a while, wants to be lieutenant governor. So what happens if you attain the nomination, which seems likely? I mean, although Bob Williams is a very enjoyable, charismatic person.
Excellent campaigner. But, I think it's hard to build a statewide organization just from nothing. I mean, it's hard to do. And I've had the opportunity to travel as a state senator over the last 12 years. You meet people from one end of the state to the other. You stay in touch with them.
You're not friends. I don't hear you slamming your opponent at all.
Oh, no. He's we don't take Valley Democrats. I mean, we were happy to have, enthusiastic, energized Valley Democrats. And so it's, that's not a bad thing at all. And he's, I think, brought some energy to the campaign, which is excellent. But really, it's hard to build a statewide organization. And that's one of the things I've taken the time to do over the years. And you go to Bethel, then you go back to Bethel, and you go back to Bethel again. And your third or fourth trip, people begin to realize you're really interested in the YK Delta. Last year, we did a tour of some airports in the YK Delta, flew out to Bethel, and then went from there to Tuntutuliak, to Shifornak, and then to Kwagilinok, and on the same day to look at the state of the airports there. And I thought it was a really interesting trip and a good way to see just how crucial air travel is to the YK Delta and how incredibly dependent those communities are on regular air travel, which leads to a lot of other subjects, one of which is the good work they're doing in Bethel training YK Delta residents to be not only airplane pilots but airplane mechanics, which is good for everybody. The folks there get better paying jobs, and the businesses get pilots and mechanics who will actually stay. You can imagine that the turnover rate for pilots who take a job in the YK Delta from Atlanta or even from Anchorage is fairly high. A lot of folks just don't want to stay there. Their families are back home. You raise someone from Bethel to be an airplane pilot there, they're bought in. They love it. They're home. And you just get a better work environment, better pilot. It's better all the way around.
I never even thought of it, but it is sort of one of our job cultures here, really.
Oh.
Working. I mean, I know a lot of people who do it.
It's a huge industry
and
in Alaska.
It's different here than anywhere else. But I mean, you still got your basics, your weight and balance and all these regulations and all the things that is necessary to assure quality and so forth. That's great.
Yeah,
and the mechanical things is like, man, we could do a whole show on that one.
It's true. It really is. I mean, you're on the airwaves, but air travel is, you know, you can't live in Alaska without doing it.
Well, tell me, I guess, to start with about Hollis French, now that we've done the issues.
Sure, yeah, we're all done. Now we can get back in.
We talked about it a little bit before, but, I mean, you were a prosecutor who mm-hmm. decided to run for public office.
Yeah, I came to Alaska in 78, like a lot of people looking for adventure, and I wound up finding it on an oil rig in Cook Inlet. I took a job there as a bull cook, washing pots and pans at the very bottom of the barrel. And I worked my way up, but it was on a Shell platform A in Cook Inlet. I worked my way up and became a production operator, and then took those job skills to the North Slope in 84 and spent 84 to 92 at Kuparuk, second largest oil field in North America, as a production operator. And those guys work in a control room. You run the pumps and the valves and the compressors that control the flow of oil out of the ground through the separators and into the pipeline. And those were peak oil years and peak production years. But I just knew I didn't want to spend my whole life as a production operator. So my supportive wife and my 3-year-old son and I went off to law school in 92 and came back. And that's when I joined the DA's office when I got back.
Mm-hmm. And that was, that's tough.
You know,
I've been on a grand jury. I've watched it. Those people work really a lot harder than
it's hard work. You do it because you're interested in it. I mean, criminal law just grabbed my attention in law school, and I had the opportunity to meet Eddie McNally when he was still here and interned in that office, and kind of got inspired to be a DA. And you do, and you know, grand juries are eye-opening experiences for citizens. You know, instead of seeing one case as a juror all the way through to the end, a grand jury sees 10 cases in a day. And I think it's astonishing to most people the level of criminality happening right here in Anchorage right now. Now it's 10:15 in the morning, and frankly, all the bad guys are going to sleep now, right? And they're going to sleep until about 8 o'clock this afternoon, and then get up and go back on their bad cycle. But it's there's guns, there's drugs, there's robberies. There's a lot of scary stuff that happens out there. And you know, as a DA, you feel like you're sticking up for the little guy, and you're going to battle against thugs, and it feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah. Well, the thing that happened, because the process of being in a grand jury, I didn't really understand. First off, it's very hard to get off the hook.
Oh, yeah.
Because they want them to be thoroughly representative of the public. The second thing I totally was unprepared for was you almost come out of a day of duty with post-traumatic stress because you're exposed to one horrible situation after another after another after another. The traumatized people have to actually show up often.
Sure.
A while, you see the same cops, but mainly you see the same prosecutors, and you get to see how hard they have to work, Hollis.
You're jamming. I mean, the 5-day rule says if you arrest somebody, you've got 5 days to bring a charge against them. And so you might be running into court on the day they're, scheduled to be released from jail unless you indict them. And, you're bringing together witnesses, you're operating on the phone, you're trying to get a doctor. It's kind of a higher wire act. And yet, you feel passionate about it because you see the crime,
right,
the wrong that happens at the center of that case, and you get fired up.
So you're sounding like a liberal, because a core liberal value is this business of justice and fairness and, standing up for the little guy and so forth.
I appreciate you saying that, because a lot of folks, a lot of my lawyer friends who work for the public defender's office see prosecutors as sort of like a paramilitary organization. And, you tend to be more aligned with the police, more aligned with law and order. But it's true. I mean, you're basically in a, as between the battered wife and the batterer, I know which side I'm on. As between the child victim and the stepdad or the boyfriend or the school teacher, I know whose side I'm on. And you really can get passionate about it, and the cases live in your mind. I mean, you really, yeah. I mean, I still am in touch with, I did one murder case to jury verdict, you know, and took it to trial, took it to verdict, and I'm still in touch with some of the folks who were either relatives of the victim or friends of the victim at the incident where it took place. It makes a huge impact on people's lives, and they don't forget it.
Well, somehow you decided to move on to politics out of that.
Yeah, you know, it was a, my wife likes to remind me of the story that it happened about May 28th or 29th on a Monday. I got up and read in the paper that no one was going to run against Lauren Lehman in the district I lived in, and it offended me. I just think that, I thought that was wrong. And I actually quit my job to file to run against Lauren Lehman.
All right. So the people who do not, probably not familiar with him, because he was, even though he was lieutenant governor, which is an office you're aiming for now,
right.
He was a...
arch conservative. I mean, I think
He came out of a sort of a technocratic background.
Engineering. Yeah, yeah.
And he was very much in the social conservative moat, and still is, believing that the courts are overreaching, I think was one of his main things. But very,
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 pro-life.
Very hard right on right. all those sort of things. And you decided that your district, that was not reflective of the values of your district?
Well, and it turns out I was right, except for one big caveat, which was that we were running under the so-called Tuckerman-Babcock plan, the redistricting plan that joined my West Anchorage neighborhood, which is fairly progressive, with Elmendorf Air Force Base on a presidential cycle, so that the Elmendorf folks actually came out. And I won in Turnagain and lost on base, and he got me by a couple hundred votes. Uh-huh. So it was a painful lesson for me about redistricting. But 2 years later, the new plan went into effect. The Tony Knowles plan that was promulgated in 2000 and took effect in the 2002 races, and that was a much more West Anchorage district. I ran against Dave Donnelly and got into office in 2002.
The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, you don't have to bother with that 800 stuff. Just call 550-8422. You can also email to talk@alaskapublic.org. What would you say, Hollis French, is your campaign keynote? What are you campaigning on? I know you're going to the Pebble Mine hearing today.
I am. I guess the two subjects I've been stressing the most on the campaign trail are renewable energy and education. In my view, that's the long-term, 50-year vision for the state of Alaska. Take your oil and gas, sell it to somebody else, take the money from that and invest it in renewable energy projects, whether it's wind on Fire Island, whether it's hydro interties in Southeast, or whether it's wind diesel combination installations in Western Alaska. That's how you build a strong society.
Well, we're making all those investments,
and we've started. We've got a good start. I mean, frankly, the bipartisan coalition made this state a leader nationwide in renewable energy investments. But I believe that's threatened really over the next few years.
Well, I mean that. Okay, what about the dam? I mean, there's...
Susitna?
Yeah, there's politics involved in that. I mean...
I have not written off the dam. I know I make some of my friends unhappy about that, but, if you want to really get there, if you want to get to a place where you're off of hydrocarbon burning for power generation, you've got to have some big base hydro projects. And, the dam, we've looked for alternatives. We looked very hard at Chacachamna here. I'm pointing across the inlet to where Chacachamna is. And we all sort of hoped that would save us from Susitna, that it would be a viable project that would give us some strong hydro here in the South Central Rail Belt. But it didn't pan out. It turns out that the waters of Chacachamna would touch a national park, and that by moving the levels up and down, as any hydro project does, you're going to influence what happens in a national park, and people soon realized that was just not realistic. So, Susitna is, it's still on the table. Is it right-sized? Is it going to pencil out? Those are questions still to be answered, but I don't think you can just write it off and expect someday to get Alaska into a place where it's like Norway, where you've got this enormous interconnected grid of hydro projects that brings the cost of energy down and makes it possible for people to live, in a way that you don't spend all your paycheck every month heating your home or turning the lights on.
Well, yeah. Meanwhile, they've got to build a gas pipeline to... to Diamond Creek, I mean, they're going to build that thing.
I think so. Out of Cook Inlet. Right?
Yeah.
Out of Cook Inlet.
Things are, reality is kind of outstripping planning here.
Well,
because they have to do that. And here we are with our electric co-ops, essentially fossils of the New Deal, where it's all based on the rural electrification system, where you form a co-op so you can get the wires in the generation facility out to your farm. And we have the fossil of that in Alaska and all these different co-ops now.
It's highly balkanized, it's true.
and yet, the solution is some giant dam, well, who's really in charge? I mean, it's...
And that's a completely valid point, and it's one of the... I mean, even on a fundamental level, we haven't decided, do you want a small diameter gas pipeline coming off the North Slope, or do you want a hydro project that provides a huge amount of electricity? Do you really need both? And I don't think anyone's actually addressed that exact question and analyzed whether the South Central population could absorb that much energy in a cost-effective and economical way.
Hollis, you also know that there are parts of the world now where the problem is essentially one of load management, because there's so much decentralization of power generation that the central utilities in Hawaii, on Oahu, this is happening, where people don't want. They want to put it in and take it out.
It's very tricky, but mm-hmm. and I can't speak to Hawaii because I'm not an expert on it, but I just know from talking to power generation people, having a hydro base is crucial, because with wind, for example, the wind comes on and off in an unpredictable way, and you've got to have that base load to ramp up and ramp down as the winds shift.
All right, that's renewable energy, and there's obviously much more on that one, but the other one?
Education. You know, it's
so you were allied then with the people who lobbied Juneau relentlessly this year. I mean, you and Bob Williams are totally on the same page on that.
We
one.
Are, and you know what? And I won't and I won't give an I won't yield an inch to anybody on the education front. We've been working on this issue for a long, long time, and
so was the answer to raise the BSA. And
absolutely,
what is,
absolutely.
I mean, when I asked Bob about that, he went ballistic. I said, well, where does it all end? There's so many more needs coming into the educational system. It seems like it's just a black hole. You could throw endless amounts of money in it.
True. I have to agree with Bob. You know, that's not true. That's frankly what the other side says, that we just, you know, there's never enough. Well, there is enough, but you've got to fund education adequately. And if they are consistently underfunding education, then we are going to consistently point out that error until we get it right. The fact is that the pro-education forces do not control the legislature. The pro-education forces do not get their way. We have to fight for every inch of ground on education funding, and it's an annual fight, and I'm happy to be engaged in it. Just one example. Pre-kindergarten, early childhood development, there is incontrovertible evidence in reams of data that shows the single best place to make a change in a human being's life is when they're 3, 4, and 5 years old. Think of a human's life as an arc, and you're aiming this arrow into the future, and you can change the trajectory on that arrow for a few dollars at that age, because because that's when your brain is exploding with opportunity and possibility. If you forget it, if you shortchange that, then you're going to spend huge amounts more in later years. For example, every year at UAA, we spend between $9 and $10 million every year to get high school graduates up to the level where they can do introductory college work. That's a shame. Those are Alaskan kids coming out of Alaska high schools who can't do college work. So what do? How do you ever fix that? You spend some money on the front end for early childhood development. It would cost about $35 million a year to give every single child in Alaska access to quality early childhood programs. And yet we're spending about $4 million, okay? Only one child in 10 in Alaska has access to good early childhood development programs, and that just means more problems down the road. And it's not just in education. Kids who get early childhood development programs, quality ones, better health outcomes, better societal outcomes, better work outcomes. They're more productive human beings. They earn more and are on welfare less. And finally, probably most significantly for a state that has the crime problems we have, there's no program out there that reduces the level of criminality amongst people than early childhood development. I brought the ICER study with me that we paid for in 2008 that they did here looking at ways to reduce the crime rate in Alaska. And the single most effective way, Head Start. It's counterintuitive until you really think about it, and then you realize, well, that's probably right. It takes a long time to see the benefits.
Well, to go back to the prosecutor level for a moment, what do you see but all these guys in their early 20s who became outlaws, dropped out of school, became outlaws when they were still juveniles, and we don't even know what their records were back then because that's all confidential. And they're just they're dead end kids.
And what are and you can't keep them in prison all their lives. And so what do you have? You have this underclass that can't get a decent job, that's boxed out of the normal so-called life. And you know, so what do they turn to? They turn to busting open your car and grabbing the briefcase out of it. And it's just horrible. Why not educate them? Why not turn them into productive citizens? You know, it's like we're in this global competition. Right, and the global competition is who's going to get ahead and who's going to succeed in the world. And my answer is simple: the most intelligent population is going to succeed and do well. And so it's our obligation as leaders, as people who can set policy, to engineer the most intelligent population you can do it. And that requires spending, and it requires the smart use of resources.
Well, I think we really need to find some people to oppose you here on the phone lines.
Bring them in.
you're an experienced attorney.
You need to patch me into right-wing radio.
You're arguing your case here. Well, I imagine you've done some of that. It's probably been enjoyable.
It is. I did. I've been on Dave Stearin arguing about oil taxes. I did some time with Dan Fagan the other morning. And actually, it was interesting. He's got two co-hosts. One is Glenn Beagle, who wasn't there. Another one is a nice female. And I forget her name, and I feel badly. But she said, you and I exchanged emails about vouchers. And you know what you finally did? She said to me, and I'm like, what? She said, you invited me to coffee. And you said, let's go have a cup of coffee. And I said, well, okay, what do you think? But it's a small state, right? It's a small state, Stephen.
You nasty devil, you invited me to coffee.
right. And so it's, to me, it's, if you can win people over one at a time, fair enough. We'll go meet and grab a cup of coffee.
Well, I think that takes us right to what Kevin wants to talk about in Anchorage. Kevin, you're on the air with Hollis French.
Good morning. I hard time opposing Hollis on many issues. I really find him articulate and expresses some things that I strongly agree with. However, one of my thoughts is that this process that we have in redistricting, where the politicians control the process, is very detrimental to our state right now. Now, I'm an independent. I'm a nonpartisan. I feel strongly about that. I tend to lean progressive. But I would like to know if you have thoughts about how that can be changed. I think it's one of the worst things that we've got going in politics as far as how it affects the representation. And if you saw your vision manifested in terms of how it could be changed, what do you think the impact might be on our state election process?
Kevin, that's a great question, and I'll start by saying I have worked on this issue because many of us saw, many of us recognize that there's no more politically powerful tool to have at your disposal than to draw election lines. You can draw map lines that benefit either side, and it's a highly, highly, highly political process. And in Alaska, it is run by essentially the governor, who appoints two members of a five-member panel. The Speaker of the House appoints a member, the President of the Senate, and then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So it's a five-member panel. And so if the governor has one body, has either the House or the Senate on his side, it's a 3-2 redistricting board. The way to do it is to go to a truly nonpartisan redistricting board. California led the way. Arnold Schwarzenegger led the way and led to they have a nonpartisan redistricting board, and it's kind of like picking a jury. You select 100 citizens who are going to make up your panel. Each side gets to strike members of the panel, thinking that there might be political operatives in there or people you don't trust, and then you winnow that group down to a core group that then goes and works with social scientists and draws lines in a nonpartisan way. The trouble in Alaska is that it takes a constitutional amendment to change how we redistrict, and that means you've got to get a bill through the legislature by a 2-thirds majority, and then it has to go out for a vote. So what it means, Kevin, is that whoever's in political power has to surrender it. Whoever's in political power in the legislature has to give that up. And that is not
so.
It doesn't happen very often. If we ever elect 40 Joans of Arc, right? Or Joan of however you pluralize Joan of Arc, but you see what I mean. You need 40 high-minded individuals who say, you know what, this cycle, which is going to go on endlessly, is never going to stop. And whoever's in power is going to try to put the other group completely out of power. And so you have to have a long-range sort of 100-year vision that says the best way is the fair way, and then who's going to benefit? Whoever's got the best ideas. But it's a tough process to try to change that redistricting method.
Kevin?
Is there any way that the ballot initiative process, maybe not directly offering
constitutional amendment? No, it's a constitutional
thing. No, it's...
Could that power be applied somehow, use that power, that voice of the people, to push something forward? I can't imagine it right now, but... are they so disconnected that one couldn't somehow affect the other?
Remember that initiatives and referendums affect statutes. They affect the right. What I call the blue books full of statutes. But you can't touch the Constitution except by Constitution amendment, and that's set out in the Constitution. It says you gotta pass a resolution by 2/3 and then send it out to a vote. So it's a tough process to change the Constitution, and it should be, but it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Yeah, glad it's a great question.
Yeah, well, while we're at it then, the lieutenant governor runs the Division of Elections.
Yes.
That's probably the biggest power outside of controlling the copyright of the state seal, of course.
You know, and people, it's funny, people sort of downplay the role of lieutenant governor, but to me, it's an extremely important position.
Well, you also sign the regulations, but you don't have much power to do anything about.
No, you can make, you're right. I mean, you're in a, what I call a ministerial role there. But running the Division of Elections, ladies and gentlemen, is an extremely important job.
Well, yeah, and that's what I wanted to bring up, because there are things, and we've seen it. First off, picking how things are described for the voters. And
exactly. The descriptions of ballot initiatives, the descriptions of referendums, crucial. Is it understandable? Does it fairly reflect the question? Is it biased in any way in one direction or the other? All can make a big difference in how elections result.
So is it? What's the resort on that? Can the courts get involved in that?
It's happened before. It's happened that courts have stepped in and said, no, the insertion of this one word twists the meaning, twists the import.
But somebody would have to actually push it to that.
And sure.
The courts are going to be a little bit reluctant.
They tend to be deferential, up to a point, and then they say, this is not fair. And it's happened in Alaska where courts have said, nope, the insertion, should this even really be an initiative? Does it touch on, for example, we've seen that with the fish case now down coming out of Kenai, where one side says, this is an appropriation of a state resource, and that's left to the legislature. The other side says, no, I'm sure that's going to go to the Supreme Court before we get done. And it's a highly contentious question. And, the lieutenant governor has the first crack at that.
Yeah. Well, I asked the Chief Justice about that issue, and she's pretty well confirmed that what they would do is try and defer to the voters if at all possible.
Sure.
And if the thing doesn't pass.
Right. First things
moot.
First, right? Yeah, it's moot. Yeah, no, I mean, courts are very wily that way, and it's smart, which is you let the process run out as far as possible before you step in and take control of it.
From the legal point of view. Hollis French is our guest. He's running for Lieutenant Governor of Alaska. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and your call is welcome. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. I don't think I brought that up before. I somehow didn't get that in the script. But, Hollis French, what if you lose?
I don't really have a plan B right now. I am.
You can practice, right? You hang your shingle.
I can be an attorney. You bet. And my wife and I are, our son's
personal
grown.
Injury. Maybe you could do personal injury.
I don't quite see that happening. Although, no. I would need to get. I wouldn't mind going back to being a DA. I like that work. It's honest work. You go and you go and practice law and try to put bad guys in jail. It's worth doing. We may travel some. We may, get involved in the public process. I love Alaska. I'm not going anywhere. But I'm planning on winning this election.
You climbed Denali, right?
I did. Yeah, no, I did.
Is there any other candidate? To...
yeah, I challenge you. I challenge you. It was a great hobby of mine. I'm a weekend mountaineer, and actually, I climbed it with the second time. I climbed it with my dad and my wife to be. It was a small team of us, and Bob Lohr, if you know Bob Lohr, great guy. And the four of us summited. It was a windy day. You couldn't see much. But, it was 21 days together. I think that's how my wife and I knew we were compatible, is that we really had a good time 21 days on a climbing expedition. A lot of storms. We had a lot of bad weather, stuck in the tents quite a bit. But we were kind of happy to be, drinking hot chocolate and shoveling the tents out and moving up every few days.
There's some questions coming in by email, and there is a phone line open to talk to Hollis French as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Talk. We're talking with Hollis French. He's still a state senator. He's running for lieutenant governor. But in Alaska, anything can happen. And that's the first question I get over the email. A very canny political question. It's not unknown for people to attain a nomination and then bow out to allow another one. In, as you know, we will likely have a three-way race for governor and three fairly strong candidates. What if two of them chose to combine forces, as happened with Wally Hickel and Jack Coghill?
You know, that's an interesting possibility. I know there's a lot of political chess playing happening right now in coffee houses around the state. You know, what if this? What if that? What if this combination? You know, what's the magic sort of bullet? And frankly, they all have a single theme, which is how do we remove this governor from office? I mean, it shouldn't go without saying that the object of all of this is because there's a vast majority of people in the state of Alaska who fear the next 4 years under a party. Parnell administration. And I think their fears are well-founded. I think unless we start to make some hard choices, you could easily, in 4 years, see a state where our savings account is exhausted and there are four or five mega projects half built, right? A half of a bridge across the Kinnick Arm, a half of a gas line coming from the North Slope, a half of a dam at Susitna, a half of a road out of Juneau, a half of a road to Ambler, and then what? And then this governor walks away. I mean, I've sometimes used this analogy, and I sort of hesitate to use it because it's a little bit scary with the air flying we all do, but we're all in an airplane, right? We're all in an airplane, all of Alaska, and the governor is the pilot. And I think he's got the ship of the state, the plane we're all in, aimed at the ground because of the way he's spending through our savings with no plan for the future. And I think 2 weeks before the plane hits the ground, he jumps out with a golden parachute and lands in the arms of an oil company lobbyist who carries him off to Houston, Texas, where he's making $500,000 a year, for the rest of his life. But the rest of us who live here, we're strapped in. And I think it's going to be a hard landing unless we do something. So I know there's a lot of thought out there about whether or not, this combination can beat the governor, that combination. And I think that still remains to be seen. I think we've got to get through the primary, see how that goes, and then take the next step.
Wow, a little bit of a hardball answer there from Hollis French. Telephone number 1-800-478-2555 if you want to weigh in on that one. 478 talk. I take it that you're definitely for ballot measure one.
I'm going to be voting yes on one. I went to work on this subject 10 years ago when Les Guerra approached me. I'll never forget it. He approached me in a downtown IC parking lot asking me in December if I wanted to help him work on oil tax reform. And I actually had to think about it for a couple of weeks because I'd come 13 years in the oil industry and considered myself and still consider myself an oil company supporter. But Les showed us that the current oil tax, known as ELF then, was broken and was not working. And just for example, the oil field where I worked, Kuparik, second largest oil field in North America, was paying less than 2% production tax. Less than 2% production tax. I mean, frankly, Kuparik stands as the strongest counterexample to every argument that the no on one forces are making. We lowered the production tax at Kuparik every single year for 10 years, from 96 to 06, from 12% down to 2%. Steady decline in the production tax, predictable mathematical decline. And under their theory, that should have exploded in production, should have exploded in investment. The pipeline should have been jammed full because every year the production tax was going down. But it didn't work. We tried their idea already once at Kuparik, and it failed. The Kuparik field declined at 7% every year from 96 to 06. And I think it just stands as a cautionary fable to folks who somehow think that simply dropping the tax on the North Slope will turn production around. It's been tried. It didn't work.
So you were there, if I get it right, you were there actually when the handover happened to ConocoPhillips?
I worked for ARCO, which was the predecessor of ConocoPhillips. That happened actually after I left. I left there in 92 and went off to law school, and I think it happened in 94 or 95. Merger, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And that, but you know, the same thing still applies. The investment was headed westward, and that was Alpine.
Getting ready for
and
Alpine,
that was
yeah.
getting over into mm-hmm. NPRA, and that there's permitting problems there. It's that struggle is still going on.
Right, and it's more about permitting and more about access than it is about taxes. Yeah. You know, and I think and
well,
ConocoPhillips,
I mean, that's the thing, as we were discussing last week, that a lot of these investments take a while.
Absolutely. I mean, the North Slope's still a hard place to do business. I mean, it's not.
I don't know that we can really slam ARCO for all the money that they made because of ELF. You know, I'm just not really sure if how much reinvestment there really was. And, you know, how long it took to pay off and like that.
All I can promise you is that we tried their theory. We dropped the tax rate every single year for 10 years in a row. And it didn't result in a pipeline full of oil the way the governor has promised us. And so that's the point I'm making, is that go into this with your eyes open, Alaskans. Look at Kuparik and look at the history there. And folks, oftentimes when I get to this point in the debate, they'll say, "Well, but oil prices were low then. Oil prices were so low it didn't pay off to invest." Well, the Kuparik field was built on $20 oil, and that was the model for a Kuparik field. Second of all, oil prices started to take off in 2003, 4, 5, and 6. They went from 20 to 40 to $60, which is a tripling of oil prices in those years. So it's not true that oil prices were low. They started to make wads of money. And it's funny, people try to turn this around as if we somehow have some hostility towards the oil industry. Nothing could be further from the truth. I have a BP retirement I will collect someday if they let me live to collect it, right? But seriously, you know, I like the oil industry. It's great. But their interests and our interests are not perfectly in sync. Their interests are for their shareholders who live all over the globe. My interest is for the citizens of the state of Alaska who are bound by a certain geography and aren't leaving. And that's the difference.
What's good for the canneries is good for Alaska.
Yeah,
what's the
matter
with your fish traps, man?
There's been 200 years. I mean, it started with the Russians and the furs, right? I've been to the Pribilof Islands. I've been to St. Paul. I made three trips out there as a DA. I've done a criminal jury trial on St. Paul Island, and not a lot of people can say that.
No.
It was a fascinating experience. But those people were forcibly moved there by the Russians and told, "We'll be back next year, and there better be a pile of fur seal skins." And that's how the Aleuts got to the Pribilofs. So it's been 200 years of exploitation. And I think what the industry is seeing is that people are starting to rear up and say, "Wait a minute. We're the ones who are here for the next five generations. You guys come and go. And we love you. We're glad you're here. We appreciate your business. We appreciate who you are." But the analogy goes back to being a rancher. We are the landlords. They are the tenants. We own the ranch, and they are the hired help. And with any hired help, you treat them well, you pay them well, you're honest with them, but you never forget that you're the person calling the shots.
Okay, Hollis Ranch, we got calls till hell won't have them.
Good. People are waking
up. Let's get started here. Let's go to Lloyd Jones program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Hollis French.
Hi there. I'm looking at an article that a study done by the University of Hong Kong and Indiana University that is looking at corruption in the states and estimated that Alaska is in the top 10, right at number 7 of the most corrupt states in the union. And I was just curious on Hollis's take on that.
Well, I was in the legislature when the Vico vote buying scandal blew up, and people forget how closely that was aligned with the vote on PPT, on an oil tax measure. We that was a long session. I think we had two or three special sessions that summer in 2006. We gaveled out finally on the 1st of August, and the FBI raids happened 2 weeks later. And I think for a lot of people that was one of the most shocking events of their time here to see.
Oh, come on.
FBI agents inside raiding lawmakers' offices.
Yeah, but obviously that's corruption. But the fact of the matter is, it took the feds to do it when it was right there in front of God and everyone. What was going on in Juneau, everybody knew, and the state and everybody was powerless to do anything about it.
Well, listeners, you should know that Steve Heimel is pointing his finger right at me, as if I should have done something about it. And I do. I've oftentimes gone back and thought, how did we miss this?
Well, I'm pointing the finger at us.
Fair enough. We weren't in the Hotel Baranoff room, right? We were not there. I mean, sure, we saw those guys at the bars. We saw them backslapping. We knew it was wrong, but you didn't know the level of the wrong unless you went in there with Bill Allen and he started shoving money under your nose or started waving money around or threatening you with your job or having Peacock come in there saying, I'd kill Crawl. It was just awful. And they had key people in their total grip. And so, it's probably a shame that our own attorney general didn't jump on that and run the wires, but the FBI did, and God bless them for doing it.
Well, yeah.
My thought would be, though, is are we looking at past history or should we be concerned with current history?
What a softball, Lloyd. Go ahead, Hollis.
Well, I'm not sure it is a softball. I mean, I've read those studies and caught the headlines, but I'm not sure what evidence they're using over the last few years of corruption. Certainly things don't go my way in Juneau as often as I'd like them to, but I can't call that corruption. So I guess I'd need a little more amplification about what factors they look to, whether it's campaign contributions or whether it's the redistricting process or whether it's, frankly, the biggest problem we're facing in Alaska right now is from Citizens United. $15 million of direct corporate spending on this ballot measure number one would not be happening were it not for Citizens United. Do you know how many individuals have contributed to the No on One campaign? Nine individuals have actually put their money up to help the oil industry defeat this measure. Okay, we've got a thousand.
There's been a bunch of small businesses put up signs.
This is a number that came up at the debate last night at the Wendy Williamson, which was shocking to me, is how few people have actually put their money to work alongside the industry.
Hmm. Any more, Lloyd?
No, I appreciate the response.
Good question.
Yeah, it's not really corrupt if it's all done out in the open, as we found with the Ted Stevens case. Dale joins program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dale.
Thank you. My concern, and leading to a question, is for the previous 3 years, the governor presented a very frugal budget to the extent that for 4 years, education didn't receive a dime. And now, all of a sudden, the governor became the education governor. He allocated hundreds of millions of dollars throughout the state. Needless to say, many shovel-ready projects were undertaken this summer. Spring and summer has resulted in an increase of economic activity. Is it reasonable to say that the governor has used the state's treasure as his own revenue for re-election?
Dale, that's a great question. And I guess I would modify some of your facts a little bit to point out that when the governor declared this the year of education, he also came out with an $85 a head increase in the BSA, $85. When those of us who are pushing education in line with the Great Alaska Schools Movement said the right number is $450. So I thought, frankly, that it was a fairly tepid education bill. Moreover, in the year of education came last. It was the absolute last bill we dealt with. And so the governor didn't get a lot of didn't push hard enough to make it a priority to get it done in time for us to really do a thoughtful approach. What we ended up with was a bump this year and then flat funding next year and flat funding the year after. So I think your overall point is fair, which is I think the legislature and the governor are trying to get over the hump of this election before the real pain sets in next year. If you thought this year was frugal, wait till next year. You're going to see continued pressure as the legislature sees the end of its savings accounts. We took $6 billion out of savings this year, $3 billion for the unfunded liability, the retirement problem, and then $3 billion more to balance the state budget from last year and this year. That leaves about $11 billion left in savings, and that's going to go faster than people think. And when that's gone, hard landing, and frankly, the people who are pushing the no on one seem to be in a big hurry to start paying an income tax or sales tax. They want to pay one as soon as possible because it's inevitable that it's going to happen, and it's unfortunate.
Does that answer your question, Dale?
You did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
It's Talk of Alaska. Hollis French, running for a Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor, is our guest today. And it's been kind of a freewheeling discussion and a rather supportive crowd of callers, I have to say. David has a broad brush question regarding kind of, I think, the future of Alaska. You talked about extraction of resources earlier, and he says, is there any way we can do more in terms of having incentives or penalties for no value added, whether it's logging or...
I think mining is probably the single biggest example there.
You want smelters here, Hollis?
No, I want them to pay something for the minerals they extract from Alaska. I don't know. Call me crazy. But, the resources moved once, sold once, and gone forever.
I see a great jewelry business building up here.
Have you been to Juneau during cruise ship season? Somebody's making money selling jewelry here. I'm not sure it's Alaskans. I think those folks sort of work the circuit globally. Wherever the cruise ships are, they open up their shop a week ahead of time and close when the last one leaves. But there is money to be made in that business. And it's a serious question. And I think that, as a government official, I have great caution in this area because I just this week went to the Dome in Anchorage where the Ultra Marathon was happening, which is built right next to what's now a church, which I visited when it was in its death throes as a seafood processing plant. The seafood money was appropriated before I got into the legislature to build the plant down there on Raspberry, but they were trying to stay alive once I got elected, and I visited a couple times, and it looked like it was going out of business soon. There were like five people, these sepulchral kind of dark people in this huge warehouse bringing out fish sticks, asking you to try these fish sticks to see if you'd give them $20 million to keep the fish plant alive. So I think government has to be extremely careful in the approach it takes to diversifying the economy. My view is, look, build smart Alaskans. Build the smartest ones you possibly can. train them from toddlers up through the university to be as smart as and creative as possible and turn them loose. And they would, you know, if you give a smart person a broadband internet connection, they can do wonders no matter where they are on the earth. So I think, you know, in my approach is more about building an intelligent population and less about direct government intervention in the economy and trying out different things to see what works.
Yeah, you would think it would be logical when you have so many people in Anchorage and so forth and all the transportation in and out that having a fish processor here would be almost a no-brainer, almost had to succeed.
And
but?
Yeah, you know, and exactly. And so, and it's easy to get sort of caught up in the herd of the moment, and this is the answer, and you know what, all it takes is $50 million. But you know,
that's all it takes.
That's all it takes. Yeah, you know, when I'm spending your money, it's really, really easy to go off on the wrong foot. And when you're spending your own, you know, it's a different deal.
Okay, let's go to Fairbanks, and Sean joins the program. Sean, you're on the air with Hollis
Thank
French.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about this Proposition 1. The way it was, the way they actually got the bill through, first of all, the governor, you know, was a head lobbyist for ConocoPhillips. Secondly, two senators were actually on the payroll. They actually work for ConocoPhillips, and their senators were allowed to vote. It just, I mean, if this isn't corruption, I don't know what is. I mean, these guys aren't just oil field workers. These guys are executives in ConocoPhillips. And I commend Hollis for trying to, you know, basically show that these oil companies are trying to buy this election. And it just makes me real angry. And I applaud Hollis for standing up.
All right.
Sean, good remarks. As I look forward to the general election, you know, I see Alaskans having a clear choice. You know, Alaskans, I've been, you know, it may turn out to be a three-way race, and it may turn out that you've got. And I'll just pose the question: you know, do you want a guy who's spent his career as an oil and gas attorney? Do you want a guy who was an oil company lobbyist? Choice two. Choice three is the man who ran the permanent fund. That's Byron Mallott. And I think once Alaskans, well, you know, once the Senate primary is over, once the repeal campaign's over, and the eyes of the state pivot onto this race, they're going to see a unique individual, Byron Mallott, running for governor, who really has a remarkable history, a remarkable record of service, who really is a bridge builder. I mean, it's kind of interesting. If you think about where he's from Yakutat, which is sort of in a bridge position, halfway between South Central and Southeast. And I think that's really who he is. And he's just got this inherent strength and this inherent authority and sense of himself that I think is going to be very, very compelling. Once people it takes a little while to get to know Byron. He's not a person who grabs you by the lapels and pulls you in close like LBJ and sort of blows you over. But he's just got this quiet authority that I've always found very compelling and very very charismatic.
But to go back to the point that was raised about corruption, it's not corruption when it's done out in the open. And you know, as a U.S. senator, I mean, as a state senator.
Yeah,
sorry
no,
about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You're not
small. I'm a small S senator. Yeah,
right.
Small S senator. Right.
But you know how it works. First off, your constituents knew that when they elected you. And if you do not vote, you are denying representation to the people who elected you, and your colleagues in there are very aware of that, and they insist that you do step forward and stand on who you are, where you are.
And I've made that point, Steve, and I think it's a fair point. You know, I know a lot of people feel like they were wronged. I mean, the vote on this bill, on this oil tax bill, leaving the Senate was 9-11. And it was, frankly, the third year the Parnell administration had tried to shove a bill through, and they hadn't been able to when there was a bipartisan coalition of senators who had gavels and who had the ability to ask questions and force answers or force non-answers out of the administration. The redistricting process blew up the coalition. It took aim at six Democrats, and they got four. They got Albert Kukesh out, Betty Davis, Joe Thomas, Joe Pascman, all taken out by redistricting. I won my election by 59 votes. I went from having a fairly comfortable West Anchorage seat to a seat that went all the way down into South Anchorage. And right now, I'm the Democrat in the state.
So they couldn't put Elmendorf in this.
Well, I'm sure they thought about it, and I'm sure they wish they'd drawn the lines just a few more blocks over, right? I mean, I'm sure they were kicking themselves going, you know, all we had to do was just go one block over. But the point is that I think I'm the Democrat now in the state that represents represents the most Republican district, right? No one other Democrat, you know, represents as Republican a district as I do. And I got elected by being true to myself. I didn't suddenly become a Republican. But, you know, on things like Pebble, frankly, that's a vote getter. I mean, I was adamant in my opposition to Pebble starting 4 years ago, same 2 years ago, and I got lots and lots of Republican votes by being anti-Pebble. But back to the point, you know, the folks who voted on that bill did run as who they are. They were not misleading anybody. And the next point, though, is that Bill Walkowski has filed a bill to change our conflict of interest rules because I think they do need to be looked at. When there's so much money riding on one question for one employer of one individual, it may be right to exempt that person from voting. And it does disenfranchise voters. And so it's a very, very tricky question, but it deserves to have a hearing. And he had a hard time getting a hearing on that bill, which is unfortunate.
Lieutenant Governor, dealing with ballot measures, Alaska is kind of almost a battleground on the abortion issue. Just getting your position on it.
I support a woman's right to choose. Period. You know,
as with Pebble, this is where you stand.
That's
period.
Where I stand. You know, there's of all the issues, probably the choice issue is the worst one for trying to, you know, weave your way into some middle ground. You know, pick a position and let folks know where you stand. I support a woman's right to choose, and in my view, that's a decision that a woman should make in consultation with her doctor, her family, her faith, and that's it. You know, if there's ever a place for small government, it's to stay out of the inside of the bodies of the people who live in our society. I went to a meeting yesterday, a Planned Parenthood meeting on campus at UAA. There was good turnout of young people, very, very concerned about this issue. And it's always going to be a battleground until we, as a society, decide to set it aside and move on because this is about a person's personhood and how they control their own lives.
Harry in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Hollis French.
Good morning.
Good morning, so Harry. Harry Crawford.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I want to talk about hard landings. I believe that SB 21 is going to reduce the amount of state revenue. We're already running deficits. I think that the next source of revenue that they're going to come after is the permanent fund dividend. And we worked together on a constitutional amendment, put the dividend into the Constitution. So I'd like for Hollis to comment on the hard landing.
Okay, really short, Hollis.
You know, Harry's right. When we run out of savings, and I think it's important to note that the same people who voted to reduce oil taxes, if they had to vote for a revenue measure at the same time, would have backed out and chickened out. So they're coming after your dividend, folks, or it's going to be an income tax, a sales tax, a party dividend, a balanced state budget.
Be about 2 years, wouldn't it?
I want to push it off as far as possible. Those folks seem to be in a hurry. Vote yes on one, folks. And is this the end of the show?
It's the end of the show.
Steve, where does the time go? Thanks so much for having me on.
Where does the time go? Who knows? Thank you so much
for having me on. It was a great day.
Hollis French, our guest next week, Wastewater Gardens with Biosphereian Mark Nelson, Josh Edge, Sean Carpenter, and Dave Waldron on the crew today. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.